Yes. A lot of our spiritual life, years of discovery, years of practice and education, are referential. We pursue a topic of interest right, through mind, the power to conceive, to agree and disagree, or to perhaps envy someone else's spiritual experience, you know, well or poorly articulated. And naturally, we create heroes and villains, heroes and monsters in our own imagination as we are exposed to the teachings and teachers and stories and narrations of all kinds of, you know, gifted, remarkable persons. And that quality of affinity or quality of affection, you know, is grist for the mill, is an expression you could say of one's own longing, the thrill of discovering what else is in store in consciousness than what we have come to expect or presume consciousness or experience to deliver. So we get naturally excited about miraculous events, miraculous stories, miraculous persons, and their seeming disengagement with the world of sorrow and the world of suffering. But invariably, our affection and our illuminations are perhaps emotive, didactic. And they may run out of deeper satisfaction or deeper nourishment. Because living secondhand, even in admiration of a glorified spiritual figure, doesn't quite bring us all the way or further. There's diminishing returns when we use emotive and sentimental capabilities and didactic capabilities to carve out our place in the Dharma. So it may beg the question at some point in a life's journey, what's not secondhand? You know, devotion is secondhand. Meditation at many levels, let's say, is secondhand. We can have furious and sometimes ecstatic experiences, devotionally or otherwise, but they, you know, come and go like everything comes and goes. So it's difficult to place our loyalty in the hands of practices, teachers, teachings, and the like to serve our spiritual nourishment. Our predilection, our conditioned habit, is to entrain with the storytelling mind, the mind of time, the mind of causality and implication, as concerns myself, my body, my emotion, my sentiment, my sense of security or lack thereof, my self-esteem, excuse me, or lack thereof. And this is also secondhand living. We're interfacing with the presence, the streaming nature of present experience, secondhand, behind the conditioning, the insulation, the insubordination of myself or the imagination of myself. Something else besides the habit of sentiment, narrative, didactic, and pursuit may arise spontaneously in one so-called experience that you could say gifts us with a more formidable absolute sense of non-apprehending intelligence. Perhaps you could even say non-utilitarian intelligence. Presence stripped of agenda, movement, acquisition, self-association, and reference reveals some companion qualities. Those companion qualities are punctuated by a organic and effortless cessation of presumption, of accusation, of acquisition, of any habit for referential meaning. Similarly, these qualities, companion qualities, that arise quite spontaneously, you could say free us from the momentum and inertia of personification, self-identity. This is a very easeful transmutation in ordinary consciousness. Yes. Yes. Yes and yes. Our, you could say principal orientation or the on-ramp to spiritual appetite, spiritual understanding or practice is strongly influenced by knowledge, experience, didactic understanding, comparison, and coming up with clever, better, more subtle, let's say, answers and framing of the curious nature of experience. So we can become Dharma combatants, whether in the Hindu realm or the Buddhist realm, or certainly the Islamic and Judeo-Christian realms, we become Dharma combatants, Talmudic combatants, Pali Canon combatants, because we imagine that's what's been conveyed, and that what we've read and studied is true, that it presents a secular / spiritual reality about the nature of phenomenal expression, or life on earth for the human species, or whatever the curious framework is. Yeah. Down the road, or sooner than then, it's who knows how that happens, one discovers a different quality of inner authority, but not an authority that's based on ahas or I gotchas, or this is the way that it is, or I finally unraveled this koan, or anything at all that has to do with the realm of reference and didactic understanding based on language or symbology, which is what language is. So the appetite that we have for authentic a nourishing a spiritual experience doesn't get sufficiently nourished through years of being a pundit or even participating in exotic practices, whether they're purifications or pineal decalcifications or Raja Yoga, etc., etc. These become fetishes of an illusory relationship with whatever living is. And then these systems are also filled with, hierarchical distractions and confusion as concerns how many steps and how many years and how many prostrations. How many, japa, mala rounds, rosary rounds, how many steps taken, the whole thing. We become easily confused by hierarchical systems, hierarchical authority, and the measure of how much progress we've made according to these systems. And it occupies a lot of our time, constructively or otherwise. But it has nothing at all to do ever with the organic, unsought arising of intelligence. which is freedom from cosmology and freedom from hierarchical systems, freedom from performance anxiety or performance pressure, or the need to be recognized by, a master or a guru or anyone at all. So the habit of living secondhand if we're lucky, might mature, transmute, so that all of the psycho and emotional and somatic and sentimental and didactic pressure that appears to define, who and or what we are and the circumstances and events in which we're living, that flatlines entirely. We might think that I'm interested in, freedom, devotion, spiritual acquisition. But if the cost of that is the flatlining of one's own heretical nature, we might, back off. We might have some quarrel with a cessation. Of self-will. The cessation of competency. The last thing we want is to become incompetent. Yeah, well put. Yes. Whatever arises, if there's a feeling associated with it, especially as concerns one's spiritual destinations, climactic or anticlimactic, you can still sense, the friendship, the companionship of self-reference. And, free fall as a metaphor for present experience without coordinates. Ideally, free fall is consuming, nourishing, mysterious, not that it needs to be. The ease of being that becomes known, more formatively known and felt, that accompanies the free fall, can be profoundly engaging, but in a different language. Yeah. Free fall is contrasted with, let's say, egoic presentation or egoic identity can either be enjoyable or terrifying, sought or refused. Free fall, you could say, experienced or enjoyed on its own terms, not in contrast to egoic predilection or egoic conditioning, is a, may I suggest, a new realm. Because there's no longer any reference to, you know, I mean, my, as myself and my suffering and my aspirations in space-time as a human, you know, on a planet that might not be heading in a very favorable direction. So it's like part of the challenge then is to hang out long enough, in free fall, so that we can learn how it enjoys itself. Yeah, which is a wholly different context, discontinuous context, than, you know, the suffering aspirant getting, let's just say, some, you know, relief. Yeah. And of course, you know, there's likely to be views or vistas that, yes, I see, yes. The Peter Brown book, of course. I do the same. You read a thing and you watch a thing and then you start thinking and feeling and expressing, you know, through that influence. Yeah. It's fun. You know, the difficulty, not just with, you know, Peter, who has a remarkable and for which I'm grateful, presentation and liturgy and vocabulary as concerns, you know, his body of pointers and what he emphasizes. But you can see even those, as poetic and luscious as they may be from, you know, time to time, we will instantly fetishize and destinationize his or anyone's, you know, poetic license as concerns expectation, pacing, presumption of, you know, what present experience, or call it even enlightened experience, should look and or feel like. There's that reflex, if you will, for grasping or clinging or sense making, the derivation of meaning as it affects or afflicts me, my idea of myself, sensually and otherwise. So it's a very crafty loop of, you know, self-referencing. So if I read a new thing, or am I inspired by some other works or a form of vocabulary that I have not been exposed to before, I get excited and interested and like to, you know, go down the roller coaster of that body of work. And then it's just as useful, if not more useful, to discard it. We can say that experiencing reality, whatever we want to call it, consciousness, the absolute, yada yahoo, operates, let's say, according to non-standard means and methods. If the movement of narration and the acquisition reflex of mind is not operating, then you're not marking psychological time. You're not marking experiential time and coming up with a streaming narrative that makes one's sense of self look durational or durable. I'm down with that. I like the most honest shit out there, myself. Yeah. Paul is, he's a remarkable, entertainer and, a very gracious, being. He's quite, agreeable that his seat assignment is in the service of suffering addicts and or suffering persons, and gives of himself and his experience quite freely and generously, for a profound and intimate sense of inspiration and recalibration. Nobody knows what the fuck he's talking about because it doesn't really matter much, but everyone comes away full. Yeah. So he's awesome. Yes, and that's also true. The spiritual marketplace by design, you could say, unavoidably, is going to be full of, personas, the spiritual authority, curious, if not entertaining, means of presentation. One hopes in the service of aspirants, whether they are recovery oriented or advaitically oriented, one's mind, if there were one, not that it is one's, but the nature of mind is instant on objectification, instant on fetish creation. And it's that the projection of objects derived from the remarkable subtlety that is found in and as consciousness. So we're excited. We're thrilled to find an object, to name an object, to acquire an object, store, save, buy, sell an object. And that happens not just with the material of our lives and our clothing and our closets and our retirement and our family and friends and our automobile and our artworks and our music tastes. And it also operates remarkably subtly with the next, you could say, thought, with the next breath, with the next iteration of personification and identification. So, quality renunciation might not have anything to do with having sex or not having sex or having money or not having money, or eating after 5 p.m. or not. The quality renunciation might have everything to do with the ambiance of this present moment. Clinging to the firestorm, the seductive firestorm, or whatever is appearing in or as consciousness to me. So the renunciation is not of material things, actually. The renunciation, which is, again, effortless and couldn't really be practiced, is the the Teflon of the ease of being, meeting the ongoing presentation of subjectivity, objectivity, perceiving, conceiving, and the presumption of experience in a world. That's yeah, that's very kind. I wonder if that's actually true. You know, graciously and appreciatively, my banter and the kinds of offerings that I make, modest offerings that I make, are thankfully not broadly received. Yeah, no one's inviting me to, go anywhere, to say anything. Egoically, I can become from time to time kind of grumpy about that, but really being marginalized and unpopular is really a better place to hang out. There's something about the, the aboriginal, indigenous, native, shamanic cultures the world over, where tribal simplicity, tribal affection, the non-commercialization of things is what really fills our hearts and gives us, I would say, constructive meaning, in a more Gaic, essential nature. Yeah. The community around the fire, simply enjoying, story time, ease of being, perhaps listening to, the elders speak about things, participatory, without airs, or as few as one can muster, it's nourishing. And it's at least I find, a very organic vehicle for deeper discovery, non-dual discovery. Most seekers and aspirants, including the kinds of people that go to a SAND conference or Bhakti Fest or the UFO conference and things like that, we're phenomenon junkies, experiential junkies. We want to be in the presence of a mutant or something. We want to buy the accoutrements of the trade. And of course, that's all well and good. And if you had the money and the time and the inclination to go to various conferences and get stoned on the presence of other people doing SAND, doing UFOs, doing Satnams, Hari Babas, that's fucking great. Go on a yoga cruise. Get vegan training. Do, Ramana Maharshi book study, but fuck it. That's all secondhand. It's all indulgence in secondhand spiritual materialism, which is fine. Wonderful. So it's really, up to the aspirant, the journeyer, to discover what's, you know, truly nourishing and helpful to them. Yeah, when we're tired of circumstances and events and security seeking and knowledge mongering. Yeah. Right. When that distraction wanes of its own accord, then, you know, we're left with ourselves. Our invitation is the discovery of non-referential intelligence, and it sure as fuck doesn't need yoga or Patanjali or Nirsagadatta or Peter Brown or Paul Hederman or anybody. Though, of course, all of these resources are, you know, gifts and helpmates, aids along the way, of course, to cultivate one's own experience without having to make any claim about anything. Freedom, you know, whatever that might be, can accompany a deepening appreciation that, you know, this isn't about anything. The inertia of personification, the inertia of personal identity, goes into a natural abeyance or relaxation with the appreciation that this isn't about anything. The urgency and appetite for meaning and validation, well, drives us insane. Drives us to extinction. You know, it's a timing thing. When the time is right and ripe for a, you know, spiritually aspiring or spiritually minded person, if and when to alleviate themselves of the presumptions of others, the knowledge of others, the experiences of others, the frames of reference that imbue and taint our native consciousness and suggest boundaries and conditions and contexts for our right to be. When all of that is discarded, that Course in Miracles gone, Ribbu Gita gone. I mean, everything is shreddable. Then, without any reliance on Any prior knowledge. Here's, oh fuck me, here's naked presence. The renunciation, the invitation for a profound renunciation is present. If I'm not the product of authority, culture, social narrative, performance pressure, this freedom is baskable. One may bask in this. And no claim need be made for myself or anything. There's no one and nothing to heal, and yet there's no refusal to avoid an encounter where, you know, you may be called upon to be useful, to be present, to be a friend. And the good fortune not to monetize that, you know, at least in this society, can be quite lovely. Yes, thank you, yes. How quickly this isn't about anything turns into a new orientation is indeed mind-boggling. That's the yoga. That is exactly the yoga, whether it's Paul Hederman's yoga or the yoga of radiant presence, or you name, you know, Nirsagadatta's teachings, or even Ramesh Balsekar, you know, dot, dot, dot. We can throw Jeff Foster in for good measure, even though he's, you know, tends to be kind of emotionally solicitous, sentimentally solicitous. But that's the razor's edge. Without grandiosity or grandeur of any kind, here this is, and somehow call it awareness, attention. It doesn't need to be personified or even named. Is capable of witnessing, you could say, seeing, discovering, you could say, its own miraculous capacity for instant association, instant on duality, instant fetishization, the instant apparition of time. It's faster than quick. You're peering right into the fire, where one could say nothing. Masquerades as something. That is mind. It's not that there's actually mind. There's no mind. There may be a brain, but that's not very useful. There's no mind. However, you could say there's maybe we could call it a verb, a curious and impersonal exotic action. That action being consciousness, whatever it is, imagines that it has found something. If it imagines that it has found something, there's an instant on duality between the consciousness as the perceiving plenum or the perceiving capacity and that which it has found. So the instant that anything becomes an object, bam, there's the embedded and innocent projection of subject and object, or the separation or split that accompanies the curious miracle of experiencing. Then, you know, that's the engine of all angst. It doesn't fucking matter whether it's attraction or aversion, because attraction and aversion is way, way, way downstream of the principal hallucination, which is that consciousness, having found something, insists, and again, this is, you could say, unconscious and has an automatic nature, reflexive nature. Consciousness finds anything at all and it insists that it's not that. Now there's two of us. That happens faster than one can measure. You know, that may even be occurring timelessly, if not acausally. So if the curious magic trick of a singularity presuming to be other than itself is acausal, then how the fuck are we going to get a leg up on it? We're always and only a symptom of that principal miracle. So what can a symptom do? Be a symptom. Yes. That's how this rolls. It's streaming symptoms. And the receipt of streaming symptoms of the apparent and apparitional capacity for engaging with whatever the fuck this is, curiously insists on being two. So it's, you know, it's a symptom party. It's a symptom that suffers. It's a symptom that heals. It's a symptom that imagines it's making spiritual progress. It's a symptom that makes a claim about itself. Fuck it. And it's not like you can, avoid, mitigate, or medicate this reflex of reality to symptomize. You can't. You're already a symptom. What can you do about it? However, there might be the curious discovery, revelation, if you will, kind of a revelatory appreciation, frustrating, terrifying appreciation of the streaming nature of presentation, the streaming nature of consciousness or perception, the streaming nature of the most marvelous and minute, fractal, sub-symbolic discoveries that can be made in the plenum and plasma of consciousness. Man, they're fucking tiny. Really tiny. And tinier than tiny and implied only. Yeah. So this is a plasma of streaming, remarkably subtle, hollow, dynamic implication. And we don't see it on those terms. You could say we're too, you know, busy. We're already imbued or inebriated with the mantle of the presentation. So it's very challenging to cultivate a quality of sensitivity or a quality of consciousness that is capable of rolling back behind, you know, multiple layers of gossamer distraction. Keep rolling back behind all these layers of distraction and just see how absolutely fucked you are in a pleasant way. In that the very consciousness that you think you may be, one thinks one may be in possession of, is just a symptom. But the rubric of pride, of orientation, of reference, and objectification happens so quickly and so pervasively that we imagine that indeed we are personified. And as so-called humans on the surface of a planet consuming fossil fuels and fomenting profound extinction pressure on other species, destroying biodiversity so we can grow more food to feed more people in a never-ending conflagration of population growth. that occurs, you could say, with absolute innocence, even though there's plenty of nefarious deeds that occur within cultural context, finance, banking, oil and gas, military, religion, et cetera, so much violation, so much violence, so much boundaries, so much unbridled appetite, so much naive exploitation. But that's understandable, really, as one appreciates just how profoundly the nature of apparition occurs and how the engine of personification occurs underneath the radar of, we'd call it, conscious appreciation. So the material aspects of, jnana, call it jnana yoga, which has to include bhakti yoga, karma yoga, raja yoga, right? Stream entrance, whatever the hell metaphor you want to use. All of those, you could say, discovery vectors meet, perhaps converge here, right here, right here. Oof. Without cosmology, without burden implication, just right here. And the capacity, the maturing capacity, willingness to see how this is dreaming. You could say, Peter Brown, the person you're reading now, we'll use the metaphor of surfing, right? Surfing apparition. Surfing the miraculous engine of consciousness, the engine of phenomenon, the engine of radiant presence. Here it is, doing what it does, and one can be in acausal receipt, acausal participation with the streaming nature. Without motive, without agenda, without destination or quarrel, it's unadorned. Streaming nature, in the midst of all the chaos that it appears to foment, is also absolutely unadorned. And the subtle sensuality, formidable sensuality, that can accompany the yoga of surfing, the yoga of traveling lighter, the yoga of radiant presence. You know, the Shaktipat. Which is the fundamental nature of present experience. Surfing, the surfing doesn't know it's surfing. The immersive nature is released from any remaining sense of an experiencer, a discovering experience. The you know, the fascinating pressure of conceiving operates impersonally, spontaneously, and has the capacity to self-accuse or self-justify. So instantaneously and with no effort at all, we become imbued with the accoutrements of personification. And the accoutrements of personification, you could say, is the stuff of I. To either celebrate the world or to deny the world is too heavy. And of course, it's, you know, absolutely fine. And why shouldn't we go on either celebrating the world or, for some, denying the world? Yeah. You know, it's to suggest that what happens behaviorally or circumstantially, karmically, has no, may I say, actual TCPIP connectivity with the unadorned nature of reality. You see, as an entity, we like to think that there's, you know, connection and implication and things to discover and or things, you know, to do. But yeah, that's right. That's just a presently appearing urgency or reflex of, you know, what should I do, think, feel, say, express next, according to what exactly? So we love the rhythm of things found in consciousness, because we rally around that which is found in consciousness to feed the beast or feed the hunger for personification. There's nothing, you know, right or wrong with it or anything for that matter. Perhaps we'd be better off with a little less violence and a little less subterfuge. But I'm not holding my breath. This isn't about anything, you know, has a corollary, which is that it sure as fuck isn't about you or me. Yeah. Erasure, you know, is a gift. the erasure of superstition, belief, you know, of the erasure of entitlement, and you know, all forms of chauvinism. It's a higher power thing. There's wonderful parallels, of course, between the practical wisdom of 12-step relinquishment and the discovery of unadorned consciousness. One relinquishes the inertia and the momentum of self-interest and takes a risk to be nourished by, sustained by, made whole by, you know, mysterious forces. Without exploitation, like, you know, the church, or all of them. Yeah. The discovery of the divine, the discovery of the sacred, the discovery of, you know, Brahmanic wonder. Is best when it's non-exploitive, when it's not turned into a fetish or some form of authority or means to an end. If we need something to be true, we're too late. Needing something to be true is already, you know, downstream of the principal symptom. You know, the personification of consciousness as self and other. So that identity matrix of self and other being individuated, personified, you know, that is a symptom. But you could say few, you know, human beings, whether religious or spiritual or secular, you know, get into the heart of it, get into the meat of the apparition of personification. So most of our craving, you know, has to do with material objects and sensual pleasure and one or several forms of chauvinistic exploitation and power over others. Which is kind of a big oops. Before any of that gets lit, there is this. There is unadorned consciousness. The reflex of personification and the irritability, the dukkha, the impermanence, anicca, the anatta, not self, that accompanies personification. Appear as both vehicles and an obstacle to the fruition of simplicity. Now, do we have an interest? Do we have the verve to relinquish belief, to relinquish superstition, to relinquish the vagaries of personification? To simply sense and surf the engine of apparition. Without any inhabitation. This is the engine of apparition, if inhabited. There's confusion. If inhabited, there's quarrel and insufficiency. Here's the engine of apparition. If there's no habitation or inhabitation, then this is the streaming presence of the engine of apparition. Without the reflex to inhabit, to personify, what is it then? I agree. Yes, it doesn't sell very well. Buddha referred to unadorned consciousness as cessation and nibbana. This is the miraculous engine of apparition and personification. Without the concomitant inhabitation, identification, then though it persists according to its formidable nature, unstoppable, insoluble nature, cessation and nibbana are also miraculously present. Not as the release from something, because the release from something is already downstream of perceived incarceration. So this is here, just this is prior to incarceration, and therefore it's not really relevant to refer to it as release. This has a formidable, absolute nature. And, you know, you have to be willing to be a little crazy, or go a little crazy, and perhaps stay a little crazy. Yes, to point out that as apparitional as this is, as insistent, streaming, evocative, unyielding, that as this is, it's also always prior. And the release of conceiving the beauty and strange beauty, the confounding beauty of conceiving, here this is. This is the release of conceiving. This is cessation and nibbana. Neither prior nor after. The implication of two is released, relieved. But one does not run around making claims that it's all one, because that's not quite true. It's all one, we're all one. It's like, yeah, no. Shh, be quiet. So, curiously, it reveals itself to itself. You and I are just, you know, collateral damage. We're inconsequential to the self-revelation of that which is prior, revealing itself to itself, even in the midst of the ongoing cascade of apparition. How willing are we to relinquish the familiarity of our own consciousness? the temporal and the spatial and sensual implications of our own consciousness. Then there's no longer any appetite for whatever might appear to be enlightenment. I mean, that can just fuck off. Everyone and everything are free to fuck off, including the loyalty that I might invest in my own apparent consciousness. The apparition of my personal duration or durability, or meaning. Whatever consciousness is, it may very well go on finding objects and then self-deluding. And why shouldn't it? But neither the capacity to delude or the capacity to reveal, need to concern you any longer. So there's a truly uncanny relinquishment, even in the midst of ongoing conversation, there's an uncanny relinquishment of the apparition and the implication of conceiving, even while it's occurring. Well, I guess that ought to do it. It's 9 o'clock or so. I can't thank you enough for being here to chill and hang out, to throw something in the chat room so we could have a conversation. Perhaps others may benefit from this by listening to the recording. Fuck if I know. So I'm grateful. Thanks for being here. See you again.